This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, concerns over the state of the Kokoda track and a push to bring it under new management.
It's in the worst condition it's ever been in the 32 years I've trekked across it.
Also, Pacific conservation experts meet to discuss the world's oceans, and we learn what a slip of the tongue from US President Joe Biden could mean for US relations with PNG.
I think it's a very unfortunate statement, given the geopolitics that is playing in this part of the region.
All that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans, filling in for Agitupo. Thanks for tuning in. But first, another piece of history will be made on the already historic Kokoda track in Papua New Guinea later this morning. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese will become the first sitting PM to walk part of the gruelling 96-kilometre mountain track, and he'll be accompanied by his PNG counterpart, James Marape. It was the site of fierce fighting during World War II when Australian soldiers, aided by local villagers, repelled the Japanese advance on Port Moresby and established a close bond between the two countries. Mr. Albanese arrived in Port Moresby last night for a state dinner and will fly to Kokoda Village later this morning. Going along for the ride is ABC News political reporter Melissa Clark, who joins us on the line now. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. This has got to be one of the more unusual assignments you've been on as a political reporter. What sort of preparations have you had to undertake?
It's certainly not the usual task for someone who reports in Canberra, but I'm very excited about it. It's a great chance to get to see the famous Kokoda track up close. Look, for me, I'm a big bushwalker. I love going out into the wilderness, so I do that fairly regularly, but I'm afraid the cold and frosty mornings in Canberra at the moment haven't been very good preparation for the heat and humidity of the tropical jungle. So that will be the big test for me and probably for the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, too.
No, I grew up in Canberra. I can certainly relate to those freezing mornings. and look, talking about PNG, I dare say much of your experience today will be dictated on the weather. I need to ask, have you checked the forecast?
I was told not to, lest I get too much anxiety, but looking out the window, which of course is a great forecast for at least being able to get out of Port Moresby and up to Kokoda Village, where the walk of the two Prime Ministers is starting today, the sky is looking pretty clear, and the locals are telling me that the weather for the last few days has been very good, very stable, so I think this is the best chance we could possibly have of whether or not interrupting the set plans we've got at the moment.
Excellent. I'd certainly prefer heat over rain, I dare say. So now talking about the track, which part of the track will you and Mr. Albanese be walking? Is it a particularly steep part?
Yeah, so the part will be from Kokoda Village to a place called Isarava Village, which anyone who's had a connection with Kokoda or familiar with the Kokoda battle will be aware of. It's a section that has some flat walking, but some very steep walking, particularly getting into Isarava. This was a very difficult area to access and the site of a very deep battle between Australian and Papuan infantry against Japanese soldiers in a key part of that six-month-long battle of the Kokoda track. So the track itself will be muddy and steep, especially on the second day that both prime ministers are walking.
Yeah, so how long is this trek going to take yourself as well as Mr. Albanese and Mr. Marape?
Yeah, it's two and a little bit days, so two main days of walking. They're not particularly long distances, but given that steepness, given how muddy it can be, and also given the reception we can expect both prime ministers to get as they pass through villages along the way, I'm sure we'll have plenty of sing-sings welcoming both high-profile leaders. It's been a very big welcome, and James Marape himself was very at pains to say it was a responsibility for his country to show a big welcome all the way along for Anthony Albanese. So I think it will be somewhat slow progress in that regard, but it should be a couple of hours walking in both the morning and the afternoon for the two leaders. And then on Anzac Day itself, on Thursday. Both leaders will be at the dawn service at the Isarava Memorial Service, and that'll conclude what will have been a pretty big 2.5 days.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about some of those stops you'll be making along the way. I imagine Mr. Albanese will be stopping to meet villagers and things like that. Do you have a sort of a bit of an itinerary of what you've got planned?
We do have an itinerary, and there's going to be a big welcome at Kokoda Village in particular, where there's a slightly bigger population and a bit of organising before a ceremonial send-off as they commence the trek. So that will be a big part. But the rest, I think the plan for the Prime Minister, and certainly for those of us trekking along with him, is to go with the flow. There's lots of other people walking on the track as well, as we are around that Anzac Day commemoration. So there's lots of trekkers who will be on the trail. We'll also have all of the villagers along the way, and I'm sure everyone's going to want to take a chance to speak to a Prime Minister as part of that experience if they do. So a lot of planning's gone into it, but there's going to need to be a lot of flexibility, I think.
Yeah, it'll be like a travelling rock band, I'm sure. You're listening to ABC Pacific Beat. I'm Kyle Evans, and I'm chatting with News political reporter Melissa Clark, who will be joining Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and James Marape for a march up the Kokoda track later on this morning. Now, Melissa, what's the feeling among other members of the press gallery pack? Do they feel up to the task?
Look, there's been plenty of discussion and research going on in the days and weeks leading up to this as everyone sort of assesses their fitness to see how they'll go. I think it's a varying range of abilities, but everyone's pretty excited to give it a go, but I think there'll be a few sore bodies come a couple of days' time. But look, everyone's been excited to take part and also excited to come to the National Parliament here in Port Moresby last night for the state reception for Anthony Albanese. That was another marker, hearing both Anthony Albanese and James Marape talk about their approach to this walk and why it's important to them and how they see it as being important for both countries. So as well as the physical preparation, I guess there's also been some, you know, deep thinking about what this trek will mean, being such a historic occasion.
Yeah. Do we know if Mr. Marape will be joining Mr. Albanese for the whole 2-day period of the trek?
Well, at this dinner last night, Mr. Marape said that it was his responsibility as a Melanesian and as a leader, that it was his cultural responsibility to make sure that he was a good host and a good security guard for Anthony Albanese from the moment he started to the moment he finished. And he committed to walking every step along the 2 days with Anthony Albanese. So quite a commitment from James Marape to walk side by side for the entire time of the 2 and a bit days of trekking. But look, it was certainly a very big offer of hospitality from James Marape. He made it clear that this is a time when he wanted to be able to look at the history of the Kokoda track, look at what had happened in 1942, look at the impact that it had had on Australian and Papuan infantry, and say that looking ahead, this is something we don't ever want to happen again, that he sees the South Pacific as being a place of peace and to never be a place of war again. And he sees drawing on that past helps send a message about the future. So look, he's prepared to do the physical work, and he's given some good intellectual thought to a reason for doing so as well.
2 days, it's certainly a lot of time together. And what has Mr. Albanese said about his reasons for him wanting to visit the Kokoda track?
Yes, he said it was something that he had raised as an idea and that Mr. Marape had gladly welcomed to do. He's made a point of trying to regularly visit Papua New Guinea, so it's an effort to show clear friendship, and I think it's an effort to show that it is beyond the sort of usual diplomatic moves where we see, you know, maybe leaders meet occasionally in very formal settings. They'll shake hands, they'll sign security agreements, as we've had between Canberra and Port Moresby, but this was an effort by Anthony Albanese to try and show a physical display of the unity between the two countries by taking this commemorative walk. So for Anthony Albanese, that symbolism is a really important part of why he's decided to undertake such a grueling physical test.
And just lastly, what about yourself? Is this pilgrimage going to be special to you in any way? Do you have any ancestors who might have served or anything like that?
Certainly, in terms of my ancestors, World War II played a very big role around Southeast Asia. For my partner, he has ancestors who particularly involved in the Milne Bay campaign. So not directly on Kokoda, but very much a part of what was happening in this part of the world at the time. So to be able to get a sense of the conditions and what that was like, obviously in a peacetime setting with all the modern benefits of communication and safety, but to be able to have a better understanding that of that and a better understanding of Australia's own history and connection with Papua New Guinea will be a really important thing for me. That's something I'm thrilled to get the chance to learn more about.
Yeah, it's going to be such a fantastic experience, and we thank you for coming on our program and sharing that with us.
Thank you very much.
Not a problem. That was ABC News political reporter Melissa Clark joining us there. Meanwhile, staying on the Kokoda track, the people of Oro Province at the northern end of the track say they're ready to play host to the leaders of Australia and Papua New Guinea. Governor Gary Juva says the historic visit, which will see Prime Minister James Marape walk alongside his Australian counterpart to mark Anzac Day, is an honour for the people of Kokoda and PNG. He says it's an opportunity to come together and discuss issues and challenges between the two countries.
We as a province, as a people, deem it to be very important. We have two prime ministers visiting the province, and in particular the iconic Kokoda Trail. And so we feel that it is an honour to welcome both prime ministers, our own prime minister, Honourable James Marape, and the Australian prime minister, the Honourable Anthony Albanese. So we see it as an opportunity also to express to them the need for our two leaders to understand the plight of the people of Kokoda and the province indeed, in maintaining this iconic trail, in ensuring that the location that has such vast and deep history is given the respect and resources it needs so that it can continue to remain the somber place of reflection for all those who served, and especially those who lost their lives during World War II. So it's an opportunity for us to present our thoughts to them and express to them our concerns that for far too long we feel that the trail and indeed the station has, you know, not received the attention it deserves in terms of resources. We understand that both governments, especially the Australian government, have been putting funds into this, but we would like a lot more attention so that we can do a great job of maintaining the station, maintaining the trail, and continuing to respect those who served in World War II from both sides and from England, from all other nations who participated in the theatre of war, where there were actually no winners. There are always losers in war.
Are you willing and able to at least give one concern that you would want to also pass on during this visit?
There are a number of concerns. One, for instance, is the Kokoda Highway, which is an iconic national highway. And a number of prime ministers have pledged to assist the Oro province in sealing this highway. A number of Papua New Guinean prime ministers, that is. And so far, that has not eventuated. We would like to see that iconic highway sealed so that the people of Kokoda and Oro province, who significantly contributed in the World War II effort, can utilize this highway to, you know, for their economic benefits, for the purposes of accessing government services, and be able to participate in the economic development of their province and their country in a meaningful way. Another issue of concern is global boiling. Global boiling, or what used to be formally referred to as global warming, is a reality which we are facing, especially the Pacific Islands. We in Papua New Guinea have been facing this for some time now, whereby we are facing the consequences of the activities of developed nations, where you see rising temperatures and global temperatures. You see strange climatic activities, natural disasters and natural disaster-like situations, floods, the loss of land near the seashores, and other consequences of global boiling, which are causing us grave concern and alarm. We want to express our views and thoughts to our Prime Minister and the Prime Minister of Australia to be our spokesperson out there, to speak on behalf of not just our province, but Papua New Guinea and indeed the Pacific, express our concerns that the developed nations pay too much lip service but done very little in terms of addressing global boiling. We are on the front line. We have front row seats to this nightmare that is unfolding before our eyes, and we're experiencing it firsthand. Kokoda is no exception.
Then our preparations on ground?
Well, we've done what we can. You know, Oro people, we are resilient people. We do what we can with what we have, and we've prepared to receive him. The different ethnic groups, dancing groups, primarily our children, they're all excited. They will be there to witness history. The children are our future, so we have given them prominence in welcoming our guests. So they will be all out there to greet our prime ministers, to walk with them for a portion, and to farewell them and thank them for coming and gracing our shores. Preparations are well underway. The different tribal groups, the villages, the communities, community leaders, everyone is excited, and we're all willing to do our best to give Prime Minister Albanese and Prime Minister Marape the best possible welcome that we can give with such short notice.
Gary Juffa, Governor of Oro Province in Papua New Guinea. Well, the Battle of Kokoda is among the most celebrated Australian victories of the Second World War, when Australian soldiers helped by Papua New Guinean villages repelled the Japanese advance on Port Moresby along a rugged mountain trail. Now, as we've already heard, Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is among the scores of trekkers heading to the northern end of the track for the Anzac Day dawn service. But in the background, there are concerns about the state of the track, that it has declined in recent years, and now, as you're about to hear, there's a push to bring it under new management.
Many a lad will see their mothers and husbands, their wee ones and wives, just because the Fuzzy Wuzzies carried them out and saved their lives.
For three decades, Charlie Lynn has led trekkers across the rugged 96-kilometre Kokoda Trail. But after his 101st trip last year, he decided enough was enough.
It's in the worst condition it's ever been in the 32 years I've trekked across it. Now, there are areas along the Brown River that are potential death traps. You'd hardly call it a track. It's about 10 metres above the river. Anybody's travelling that at night, a misstep or something, they go in with their pack on, you will never find them again.
The son of a World War II veteran, Lynn led one of the first Australian tourist groups across the famous track on the 50th anniversary of the battle in 1992. Since then, it's become a popular tourist experience and an important source of income for local villages, bringing in $20 million Australian dollars annually to PNG's economy. But over the years, Mr. Lynn says management of the trail has declined, and the tourism experience has suffered because of it.
There's not one decent toilet across the trail for them. I can't book a campsite. So what you have, you'll have two or three groups. You know, we're probably up to 50, 60 people arriving at a campsite that's got a capacity for, say, 20, 25, and they'll be having heated arguments on who's staying there that night.
Mr. Lynn says tourist numbers have dropped close to 50% since 2008, a figure that's backed up by a 2022 study by the University of the South Pacific. But other trekking operators aren't as critical. Mick O'Malley has been a guide for 18 years. He says the track's administrative body, the Kokoda Track Authority, is doing the best with what it's got.
We're bloody head and shoulders above where we used to be when I first started trekking. I agree with Charlie in regards to, you know, that it'd be great to have amazing toilets and all that sort of stuff. But by the same token, when you go camping in Australia and you go to a campground, the government don't run the campground. It's all private enterprise. It's not the government's responsibility to make sure the toilets and guest houses are clean and up to standard.
Regardless, a push is now underway to place the Kokoda Track Authority under a new government agency and improve its capabilities.
When the Kokoda Track Authority was established under the Special Purpose Authority with the Department of Provincial and Local Level Government, it was essentially parked in the wrong place. It should have been parked with PNG Tourism Promotion Authority, because Kokoda Trail trekking is a tourism asset.
That's Andy Abel, the Deputy Chairman of the PNG Tourism Promotion Authority.
It's like parking a semi-trailer in a sedan car park. So when I started to realise the gravity of the situation and how the Tourism Authority was spending millions of kina promoting Kokoda Trail in Australia, but we had no control over it because it was parked in the wrong department, I made it my business to then try and to correct this.
Andy is spearheading a push to shift the management rights of the Kokoda Track Authority from the Department of Local Level Government to the PNG Tourism Promotion Authority. and he expects it to be approved within 3 months.
I've met with the Minister for Department of Provincial Local Level Government. I've met with the Minister for Tourism. I've met with the Prime Minister. So it's now just a matter of time, not when, for the National Executive Council submission to go before Cabinet, and the transfer should take place.
In the meantime, he has teamed up with Port Moresby Governor Pauz Parkop. Together, they have signed a Memorandum of Understanding with Canada Bay Council in Sydney and the Australian not-for-profit Network Kokoda. Governor Parkop says the group hopes to fund improvements to the trail and install various other wartime attractions around Port Moresby.
The plan is to develop these sites all the way from Paga Hill in Port Moresby all the way to Buna and Sananada and those villages down at the coast of Oro Province. So it becomes a full war memorial site. And the plan on the part of our city and tourist promotion authority is to encourage and promote tourism in the area of war pilgrimage.
That's not all. He wants to extend the tourism market beyond Australia.
I think the potential for us to get more numbers here, more than Gallipoli, is there. But, we as a country and as government too, has not really developed and harnessed this potential to create the environment or to create the facilities by which more Australians can come. And, of course, the bigger with the Japanese and the USA. The Japanese, we want to invite them to come too so they can tell their story, their version of things. They also come and pay respect to their lost loved ones.
Mr. Lin says only a small percentage of people are physically able to trek the Kokoda Trail. So by creating more wartime attractions, PNG could expand its tourism demographic by tenfold.
There's an older cohort who are fascinated, again, by the military history and also the cultural history of Papua New Guinea, our closest neighbour, who would love to go there. But they've got to be able to see something. They've got to be able to interpret something. Historical market points, where a small tourism bus can pull in so that people understand the significance of the site. But the big draw card is Owens Corner. People stepped off to go to war, and many of them didn't come back. I believe it should be developed as a visitor centre, which has a library and a coffee shop, all those sort of things.
Yeah, wouldn't more tourist attractions be great to see? Charlie Lin there ending that story. And we have reached out to the Kokoda Track Authority for comment, but have yet to hear back. Well, US President Joe Biden's claim that his uncle was eaten by cannibals in Papua New Guinea during World War II has sparked a lot of anger in PNG. Last week, during a visit to a war memorial in his hometown, President Biden paid tribute to his uncle Ambrose Finnegan, who died in a plane crash in PNG in 1944. He is quoted as saying his body was never found because he got shot down in an area where there were a lot of cannibals. President Biden's mentioned the story many times before, but never claimed the cannibalism part. And US military records show his uncle's plane crashed into the ocean. PNG Prime Minister James Marape responded diplomatically to the comments, saying his country did not deserve to be labelled cannibals. He also urged people not to get worked up over it.
Sometimes you have loose words. I've met him more than four occasions today. And every time I've met him, he's always had a warm regards to Papua New Guinea.
Meanwhile, Dr. Henry Ivarachure from the Australian Pacific Security College says the comments are poorly timed given the tussle between the US and China for influence in the region. He backs Mr. Marape for the US to find the remains of its citizens who died in PNG during the war and repatriate them.
I think it's a very unfortunate statement given the geopolitics that is playing in this part of the region. Mr. Biden is president of one of the largest superpowers in the world, and who is also courting partnership in the Pacific, has to be very careful about making such sensational remarks. Yeah, whether it's proven or otherwise, it's just got to be very sensitive. It appears to be a kind of off-the-cuff comment, but Mr. Biden is known to have made such kind of allegations before. So it's not an unusual comment.
What are your thoughts on that word cannibalism, which the president has allegedly said?
I think it's a bit derogatory. It's very insensitive. Papua New Guineans have become educated, they've been civilized, we've we've advanced so much, and that's of the past. I think it just means that we're backward. Our culture is still backward, but that's not the truth. The truth is that Pacific Islanders, including Papua New Guineans, have become educated and are very advanced. They have become Christians. They have become very forward-looking, open-minded people. Yeah, so to describe them as cannibals, that's probably in the past, but that doesn't happen in this day and age.
The Prime Minister, James Marape, said that Papua New Guinea didn't ask for the war to be played out in PNG and also in the region, so maybe there should be some kind of respect should be shown here to the people.
Yeah, not only didn't they ask for the war, but there's so many unexploded ordinances that are found all over the Pacific, and they should have cleaned up the Pacific from those dangerous unexploded ordinances, which are actually causing casualties and killing many innocent Pacific Islanders from Solomon Islands all the way up to Palau. Yeah, so I think the Prime Minister has made a very, very valid point, not just clean up your remains of your soldiers, but also all the war wreck that's littered the Pacific. Oils are leaking from ships that have been sunk, and they pose a great danger to the security and the environment of a Pacific Island environment.
At this point, there have been so much talk about geopolitics in the region. So does President Biden's comment help at all or not?
Geopolitics in the Pacific is actually very, very heightened at this moment in time. A lot of US, Australia, New Zealand, everybody's interested in making sure that they are allied with Pacific Island countries. And comments like this can be very, you know, can put off those kind of developments that have been built by those countries to build very good relationship with countries like PNG and other Pacific Island states. So unfortunately, Mr. Biden is not thinking beyond, or his comments may also contribute to the way Papua New Guinea might see the United States. I think it's just a very poor and poorly timed comment from Mr. Biden. He should have understood the sensitive nature of those comments and the sensitivities around geopolitics at play in this part of the region.
Dr. Henry Ivarachure from the Australian National University speaking there.
Hi, I'm Seyuli Salamasinovan-Raiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It is that time of the morning where we take a look around the Pacific to look at what's making headlines around the region. And to do that, I'm once again joined by producer Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, how are you going this morning?
Doing well. Thank you.
That's great to hear. Well, let's jump right into it. So police in Solomon Islands are investigating reports of election-related violence in Mailata province. What's happened there?
Yeah, well, police say a group of boys armed with spears and knives from Wanlande village attacked the nearby Bulu community after the election results were posted. One person was hospitalised with injuries from that clash, and police say they're now in the area and they've already made one arrest. Police were also calling on the community in Mailata to assist them with their investigations there.
Yeah, and staying in the Soles, police are also concerned about social media posts after the election. Is that right?
Yeah, they have. Police have put out a statement saying they're aware of hateful and inciting posts that have been made by fake accounts on Facebook relating to the election. So the police commissioner, Mostyn Mangal, says he's calling on people to resolve their differences peacefully, and he's reminding the public that any calls for violence published online are a crime. So far, more than 60% of the election results had been counted as of Monday in Solomon Islands.
Yeah, it feels like that's a pretty common announcement from police in elections just about all over the world these days. Now, moving on again, the governor of American Samoa has sought to clarify reports that his territory is ineligible to join the Pacific Islands Forum.
Yeah, so this comes after the US Department of Interior released a statement earlier this month saying it had reviewed Guam and American Samoa's bids to join the Pacific Islands Forum, and the department found it was, quote, inappropriate for US territories to participate in the Pacific Islands Forum independently in any capacity, end quote. So that seemed to throw cold water on the plans, but the governor of American Samoa, La'apui Talaoenga Ale, says they recently received a letter from the US State Department saying it was still supportive of a forum bid from American Samoa. Samoa News reports the governor saying the application is still before the forum and ultimately it will be up to the leaders of the Pacific.
Okay, well, interesting. So it seems like there's hope. It'll be, yeah, interesting to see how that one pans out. Mackenzie, thanks so much once again for those headlines today.
No worries.
That was Mackenzie Smith joining us there with NewsWrap.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, Pacific conservation experts and officials have been in Europe to discuss the challenges facing the world's oceans. They were meeting in three southern European locations this month to discuss ocean conservation and the latest science in the lead up to a major United Nations Ocean Summit in France next year. Dubravka Volodar asked Pacific Ocean Commissioner Dr. Philemon Manoni, who attended the meetings, what was on the agenda.
The Pacific wants to come to these global events with a loud voice to ensure that the work it wants to do in the region and for all the ocean, because there is only one ocean, to make sure that our voices are heard, the challenges that we are dealing with every day are considered, and partners must get on board to support the work that we need to do and to coordinate ourselves in terms of looking to the global agenda on oceans, and particularly the UN Oceans Conference that is coming up in Nice, France, next year.
Now, you are there from the Pacific, and I believe there is a Pacific delegation there. What will you be calling for? What would you like to see in particular?
We are here in Cyprus to support the Pacific group in the Commonwealth organization. In Cyprus, the Commonwealth is organizing a Commonwealth Ocean Ministerial level meeting, and we wanted to also be consistent on the Pacific message throughout the different fora and platforms. Some of the priorities that the Pacific has endorsed for us under the 2050 strategy on the ocean's thematic area of the strategy, revitalizing the governance, ocean's governance in the region, making sure that or promoting the idea that countries seriously look at ratifying the recently endorsed BBNJ agreement. Also, that we get a very important and very effective outcome in the plastics negotiations that is ongoing at the moment to ensure that we rid the oceans of plastics so that, you know, we can govern our resources and so. Because started saying if we don't, in the next 50 years, that could there could be more plastics in the ocean than fish. So we are sort of following those these processes very carefully and promoting to our friends from across the globe that these are indeed important processes, negotiations to make sure that our ocean is being managed, resources are being conserved, not only for the benefit of Pacific, but for the world.
What's the status in regards to international conservation targets of our oceans?
A lot of work remains to be done in terms of the global diversity framework, the push for 30 by 30 conservation targets. In fact, the Pacific leaders have even called for 100% management across the spectrum of oceans management, both internal exclusive economic zones efforts, as well as looking forward to the eventual entry into force of the BBNJ agreement for management in areas beyond national jurisdictions. But these are important, the global diversity framework and the BBNJ agreement instruments that we think are important. And that is why we, you know, from the Pacific perspective, promoting these instruments. And not forgetting the importance also for consideration of traditional knowledge as part of the equation to support conservation strategies.
That was my next question. What's the status of efforts to establish marine protected areas and what more needs to be done to achieve these protection goals?
In terms of marine protected areas, the framework under the BBNJ, well, we hope that as soon as that enters into force, that you know, that members or parties can start looking at that. At the moment, there are some partners who are supporting the Pacific, particularly in that regard, on the design of marine protected areas and so forth. There are initiatives that we're doing internally and maybe in partnership with others. We in the region at the COP last year have also looked at initiatives for perhaps a sea lane of consisting of marine protected areas, but these are still early in the day, and we will certainly be working with partners to support that work.
How many marine protected areas would need to be set up to reach conservation goals, would you say?
I can't say at the moment exactly. That would take some work to do. But certainly is one of the tools that we can probably look at to support conservation efforts in the Pacific and throughout the globe.
What's the role of these talks in making the seas climate-proof?
This type of gatherings or platforms are important to, I think, remind all of us, that we have to do something about the oceans. We need the science to support what we do about our oceans. So particularly for us, say, for instance, in the Pacific, It is obvious that there is a whole lot about the ocean in terms of scientific evidence that yet needs to come out to support effective governance, management, etc.
That was Dr. Philemon Manoni speaking there. Over 11,000 children die from preventable deaths every year in Papua New Guinea. In fact, Australia's closest neighbour has one of the worst immunisation rates in the world. It's a position health authorities and international organisations are working tirelessly to change. As we mark World Immunisation Week, health experts say action needs to happen fast in PNG before it's too late. Joining us this morning is Child Fund's Health Program Manager in PNG, Olive Orr. Olive, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Now, PNG is among the worst immunisation rates in the world. What are you seeing on the ground where you are?
Well, in Papua New Guinea, as you have mentioned, we have many challenges across the country where the routine immunisation rates are quite fairly low. And we see that many children do not get vaccinated before they reach the age of 2.
2 years old, Yodi, is that right? Yeah, I understand 11,000 kids die of preventable diseases every year in PNG. Why is it that the immunisation rates are so low, and how did PNG end up in this situation?
Basically, Papua New Guinea is a country that has challenging geographical locations where many people, about 80% of its population, live in the rural areas. And that is one of the main contributing factors. The other contributing factor is the access to basic health services is fairly low, and when a lot of people who live in the villages do not have access to those health services. On top of that, we have bad roads where, even though they have access to the health facilities, many parents and caregivers are not able to make that in time for their children to be vaccinated. Those are some of the main contributing factors to the low vaccination rates for children in Papua New Guinea. The other reasons are such that there are low literacy levels among parents and caregivers, where they're not able to determine the importance of taking their children for vaccination before they reach the age of 1, and the others before they reach the age of 2. So that's the other contributing factor. The other that I can tell is about having an efficient monitoring and effective supervisory visits, so that by the primary health workers. So when there is a gap that not many children in a population get vaccinated, then they're able to attend to that and find a way to enable children to be vaccinated. Yeah,
I'm looking at some of the figures in front of me. Immunization rate at the moment is 33% in PNG, and I guess you can compare that to Australia, which is 95%. It's some pretty stark figures indeed. Now, you mentioned some of those undermining factors. What about things like religious beliefs and misinformation? Does that play a part in vaccine hesitancy as well?
Those were some of the factors that affected the vaccination rates, especially during the COVID pandemic times. But religious groups can be a platform to actually give and spread the good information about vaccination when it comes to advocacy and communication. So we can see the religious groups on the positive note of spreading more of the good and why it is important for children to come and get their vaccines according to the scheduled times.
Ah, it's encouraging to hear. So what kind of preventable diseases are you seeing, you know, take hold? Is it things like measles and stuff like that?
Well, there's so many. There's diseases, vaccine-preventable diseases. We have polio that was an outbreak in 2018. So that's polio, measles, and whooping cough and pertussis, and, of course, the ongoing tuberculosis in Papua New Guinea. So those are the main vaccine-preventable diseases that have been going on and off. Tetanus, which Papua New Guinea tries to eliminate in the Papua New Guinea government wants to eliminate, as well as polio, but polio came back again in 2018 and is slowly been under control.
You're listening to ABC Pacific Beat. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with Child Fund's Health Program Manager in PNG, Olive Orr. We're discussing PNG's low immunisation rates at the moment. Now, I know you do some pretty incredible work where you are to sort of, you know, stop the curb of low vaccination rates. Can you talk a little bit about some of the work that you're doing to try and get those rates up?
Thank you. So Child Fund, excuse me. So Child Fund, like many other organizations, works extremely hard to put in good efforts to try and increase the vaccination rates. Some of the good things that we do is building the capacity of the frontline workers, which are the primary healthcare workers, on immunization in practices and the cold chain management, how they can provide access to bringing those services out to the mothers, fathers, and the caregivers. The other thing that we have been doing, Child Fund has been doing over the many years, with support from the Australian government, as well as support from individual donors, is doing a one-stop shop outreach model where it's an integrated program. We do not only vaccinate children when we're out there, but we also look at other diseases, common illnesses, how we can address that, embedding JETSI into our programming and also enabling people to access services as well as referral to the nearest hospital health facilities. We also work with a cadre of health volunteers that we have trained, and they become the link from the community to the health services. So they continuously monitor. If there is an illness, then they do referrals to the health facilities. So that's how we have been working, and we continue to work. We think it's a good model, and as well as we also have strengthened some health system where we replenish the aid posts that have been run down. We try to install solar systems where diseases can be early detected, such as tuberculosis, and we also have solar lighting installed in rural aid posts where mothers can be able to deliver there. And if there is a cold chain system in place for the children to be vaccinated as early as soon after birth, then those are some of the things that we do. And we believe that it's good work. And thank you to the supporters from Australia and the DFAT, the Australian government, for that continuous help.
And just lastly, because we are almost running out of time, do you think PNG's immunisation problem can be overcome?
Yes, we do believe, and we're hoping. We have seen some improvements from some of the 1-2 years ago, and we slowly see that it is increasing, but at a slower pace. And like some of the interventions that I have just mentioned, go reaching out, doing mobile and outreach patrols to those who are very vulnerable, marginalized people that will help to increase the rates, as well as strengthening the health infrastructure. That is one of the main areas where you bring aid posts and health services closer to the communities where those children living in the rural areas can be able to access and be vaccinated.
Oh, perfect. Well, we do thank you for the amazing work that you're doing. That's all we've got time for, Olive, but thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Thank you.
Child Funds Health Program Manager in PNG, Olive Orr, speaking to us there. And that's all we've got time for on Pacific Beat today. Let's take a quick look back at our top stories. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and his PNG counterpart James Marape are this morning embarking on the grueling 96-kilometre Kokoda track in what ABC News political reporter Melissa Clark says is a historic moment.
Quite a commitment from James Marape to walk side by side for the entire time of the 2 and a bit days of trekking. But look, it was certainly a very big offer of hospitality from James Marape.
Yeah, what an experience that is going to be. I will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And after that is Nisha Daily. I'm Kyle Evans. Thanks for joining me.